From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Village in the Park in Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, we'll find out what happened to the N. Judah during Muni's long shutdown last week.
I liken it to someone getting their wisdom teeth pulled, getting braces, and a few other painful dental procedures all at once.
Then we make a stop at Stanford and imagine a world where medical care will be determined by your genes.
I want a future where everyone has access to better medical care.
And as we go to the polls today, here's a thought. Have you heard any good campaign songs lately? Probably not, but that wasn't true a century ago. Listen up. That's today on Cross Currents. For some people, the daily commute will get a little easier this week. Yesterday morning, a new ferry service opened between Oakland, Alameda, and South San Francisco. And in San Francisco, regular service resumed on the Muni's N. Judah and J. Church lines after 10 days of repair work at some of the city's busiest transit junctions.
Last stop, right to Judah.
And a new poll shows that voters are losing faith in plans for a high-speed rail system in California. Despite this, Governor Jerry Brown is proposing legislation that would give high-speed rail a pass from complying with some of the requirements of California's strict environmental protection laws. To tell us more about all of this, KALW's transportation reporter Julie Kane joins me now. So let's start with high-speed rail. Can you remind us where things stand with this project?
Sure. The California High-Speed Rail Authority, they're the ones responsible for getting the bullet trains built in California. They just hired former Caltrans director Jeff Morales as their new CEO. And Morales has really intimate ties to high-speed rail. He's an executive with Parsons Brinckerhoft, which is the company that's doing all the project management for the bullet train.
So isn't that a conflict of interest?
It might be. State Senate Transportation Committee Chairman Mark DeSaunier said he was, quote, troubled by the relationship. And State Senator Doug LaMalfa, who's always been a critic of the project overall, was quoted in the LA Times saying, "It's difficult to believe that Mr. Morales can be counted on to drive a hard bargain with the company that's been paying his salary."
So who is supporting Morales then?
Well, the Rail Authority is standing behind Mr. Morales. They say he's the best choice for the job. It's been vacant since January. And the plan for building the train is due to go before the legislature later this month. So lawmakers have to decide whether they're going to release the bond money that they need to start initial construction of the train later this year in the Central Valley.
So what's the political support like for this project?
Governor Brown is still fully supporting the project to the point where he's actually proposed legislation that would exempt the bullet train from certain requirements of California's Environmental Quality Act. It's an attempt to block opponents of the bullet train who could use the environmental law to stop construction altogether.
What kind of requirements?
Well, more details about Governor Brown's proposal are expected out next week, but it basically looks like it would mean that people who want to use the environmental law to stop the train would have to prove in court that the train would cause major environmental problems like wiping out a habitat or an endangered species. And in the past, opponents have used the law to hold up construction plans for much more minor issues.
So sounds like things are heating up.
Yeah, they certainly are. And according to an LA Times USC poll that came out last week, voters are starting to really lose faith in the project. Statewide, more than half want another chance to vote on the bond measure that they approved back in 2008 that provided the initial funding for the project. Mm-hmm. So the polls are showing that if it was up for a vote now, almost 60% would vote against it.
We'll definitely be interested to find out what happens with this. But let's move on now from high-speed trains to light rail. Yesterday marked the end of a Muni project called the Long Shutdown. Can you tell us what that was about?
Sure. The San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, or the SFMTA, they run Muni, and they shut down the entire N. Judah line and ran limited service on the J. Church and 22 Fillmore for about 10 days. Service is back up and running now, but it seems like they're still having a few hiccups. One of our reporters here noticed a long backup of outbound N trains at Church and DeBose this morning, and yesterday, right after they opened up the line again, an N train broke down in the avenues, causing the system-wide backup for most of the morning. Mm. But basically what was going on during the shutdown was Muni was working simultaneously in two locations at Carl Street and at the busy Church and DeBose intersection. And they were replacing worn-out tracks, upgrading signals, and the switches that tell the trains where to go and which track they should be on, and basically just working to make it safer for pedestrians in both places. And at Church and DeBose, they also did work on the sewers, just taking advantage of the fact that they'd already closed down and tore up the streets already there. Mm-hmm. So last week I met with Greg Dewar. He writes a blog called the N. Judah Chronicles, and he described the work like this.
I liken it to someone getting their wisdom teeth pulled, getting braces, and a few other painful dental procedures all at once.
Ouch, sounds painful.
It was pretty extensive work, and it did require this massive rerouting of some of the city's busiest transit lines, but it was the only way to do the repairs. The last time they did work on this scale at Church and DeBose was 20 years ago, and that intersection is pretty complex, and it can be really hard to navigate. There's bicyclists, pedestrians, drivers, Muni trains, and buses all going through there at once, and it's not always super clear who should cross when. So I talked to SFMT spokesman Paul Rose, and he told me they're hoping the new signals there will help make things easier for everybody.
And that's one of the things we're looking at in this intersection is how do bikes and pedestrians and transit riders all coexist in on one street. Some of the new traffic signals will help with pedestrians and the transit right-of-way.
So how much did this particular project cost?
It cost about $40 million, and that's a combination for repairs at Church and DeBose and at Carl Street. Rose said it's only a fraction of what it would cost to replace the entire system.
At this point, to replace everything in the system would cost about $500 million. We carry about 700,000 trips a day, so we have to do this work as we go.
So what's next on Muni's repair list?
Well, next up are repairs at what's called the Persia Triangle. Those are intersections at Persia, Ocean, and Mission Street on Muni's 29 bus route.
That's not far from KALW.
No, it's really close. But the really big project on Muni's list is the Central Subway, and that's due to open in 2019.
And we've got a new way to get between the East Bay and the Peninsula, right?
Yeah, there's a new ferry service just opened yesterday, and it runs between Oakland, Alameda, and South San Francisco. It's the first new ferry route that's been open since 1992, and the idea is to give workers an easier way to get to companies like Genentech.
And are there any other routes in the works?
Well, the Water Emergency Transportation Authority, which is the agency that operates a lot of the Bay Area ferries, they say the next route would bring ferries to Berkeley and Richmond.
Okay, thanks for the updates. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you.
Julie Kane is KALW's transportation reporter. You can hear more Transpo coverage online at KALW.org. You can also visit our partners at TransportationNation.org. And we'd love to hear what you think about getting around the Bay Area. Leave us a message with your opinions and experiences at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. If you live on the peninsula and work in San Francisco, you may take BART to the last stop on the line. That's in Millbrae. If you need to go beyond that, you'd have to get on Caltrain. That'll take you to places like Palo Alto, Redwood City, and Stanford University. So let's get off at the Stanford station right now to talk about a unique body of research being conducted here, the only place in the world. When scientists started studying genomes and then sequencing them, their work was hailed as revolutionary. But they were mostly done in connection with Caucasian populations and some African and East Asian ones. One of the races no one studied was the Persian race. That is until last year. Stanford researchers received a $250,000 grant from a Persian American foundation called PARSA to study the Iranian genome. The idea is to learn more about the history and varied cultures of the Iranian people and to explore the field of personalized medicine. For example, if you were a doctor and you knew your patient was from a subset of people whose bodies don't take well to a certain drug, you could avoid prescribing it. Since the Iranian government refused to allow the study in Iran, the Stanford study examines the Iranian-American population here. Raksana Danishjou is lead researcher for the Iranian Genome Project at the Stanford School of Bioengineering, and she joined me in studio.
The ultimate goal of this project is to actually put all this data and make it publicly available for other scientists to use to conduct further studies.
Further studies in regards to what? Like medicine?
Medicine, exactly. For instance, let's say that you're an Iranian with an incredibly rare inherited disease. It runs in your family. And you get yourself genome sequenced. And where you are, the medical facility where you are, they want to try to figure out what is the genetic mutation causing your condition, because then maybe they'll be able to target it with a drug. And help you, the first thing that they need to know is how prevalent are the frequencies of different variants in the Iranian genome. If they're just looking at you and they see some variant that looks rare compared to European Caucasians, they might think that that's the variant that's important. But then if they then went to the Iranian genome data, looked at that and saw, well, actually, 20% of Iranians carry that variant, then it's far less likely that that variant is responsible for your disease. And so that is able to help scientists sort of tease out in these like specific situations what mutation might be responsible for rare diseases. We're 99.9% similar genetically, and so I don't want to necessarily just highlight our differences because we are you and I are incredibly genetically similar. However, while the human population shares many of the common variation, there are rare genetic variations that can be particular to different populations.
That determine what?
That can determine disease or drug response. Let me give you an example. Asian populations have a require a 30-40% lower dose of a blood thinning drug called warfarin, and it wasn't well understood what the reason was until some sequencing was done in that population, and it was found that they carried a variant in the target of the drug that was a particularly high frequency in that population. Which is why many of them required a lower dose. And so if you sequence that variant in that individual and you know they're of that background population, then you can know to give them a lower dose and avoid the adverse event of bleeding, which is what happens if you give someone too high of a dose of that drug. So when the physician comes to prescribe a drug, let's say the drug is warfarin, to the patient, and they click to make the prescription, there's a pop-up that says, this patient has this variant of the warfarin target. Give them, you know,
X dose
instead of what the normal dose is.
So had that not been up there, had the pop-up not been there, which is the case for most of us, right?
Right.
There's no little pop-up thing that tells the doctor any information like that for most of us. So then an overdose might occur.
Right. And that's why this drug is one of a drug that has a lot of adverse events, because dosing it is incredibly difficult. And it's currently guess and test So that's one example. Another example would be statins. Statins are a very common drug that is used, you know, it's very protective for heart disease. So if you have high cholesterol, they put you on statins. And there's a very bad adverse reaction, very rare, but very bad adverse reaction called rhabdomyolysis, where you're basically your muscles break down. And there's a genetic variant associated with that. And so if a physician sees, has a pop-up that their patient has that genetic variant, they might either choose to use a different drug, or they might say, okay, I'm going to put you on the drug, but I'm going to monitor you very closely because I know that you're at much higher risk for having this adverse event.
How far do you think are we from a world like that?
I don't think we're too far from it, considering that and the reason I feel that way is because people are beginning to figure out how to put it into practice in the clinic by connecting it to the electronic medical record. And people are trying to figure out which ones are really important. Some genetic variants, including it, might not really change outcomes, but some will change outcomes. And those are the ones that are going to get adopted into clinical practice. And that sort of brings it back to why the Iranian Genome Project is important, is for this revolution to be successful, we need to make sure that we have genetic information on all ethnic groups, not just European Caucasians, but also Asian and African groups and Middle Eastern groups, and having this information, because there are differences between the populations, and what variations are carried within those populations are important for those populations. And we want, you know, I want a future where everyone has access to better medical care, because we have an understanding of everybody's genetics, not just one group or another.
Roxana Donishjew is lead researcher for the Iranian Genome Project at Stanford. And we'd like to hear your take on the genomic study of specific races. And if you're Iranian American, would you sign up? Post on our Facebook page. It's KALW News. And if you'd like to participate in the study, we'll show you how at KALW.org. For some artery, cultural coverage that rocks the vote. Whether you're Iranian American or any other hyphenated American in our diverse Bay Area, chances are today you've practiced one of your rights as an American and voted. It's election day, and polls close in about 2.5 hours. And over the past couple of months, every part of every campaign machine has been working to get our attention.
See through the smokescreen. Yes, on 29.
That's why doctors, taxpayers, and small business say no on 29.
Mitt Romney, business legend, rescued the Olympics. The Republican governor who turned around a Democratic state.
President Obama, 4 more years.
In every election, some candidates use pop music in their campaigns, but it doesn't always work in their favor. When she was For example, Tom Petty made Tea Party candidate Michelle Bachmann stop using his song American Girl at her rallies. And candidate Barack Obama had to quit using Hold On, I'm Coming because Sam of Sam and Dave, the duo that made the song popular, said he had not endorsed the future president. Would have been different, musically speaking, if these candidates had been running prior to the early 1900s. Back then, all sorts of songs were written specifically for candidates and their causes, as KALW's Stephen Short reports.
The current exhibit at the Society of California Pioneers is called Singing the Golden State. It's about the music of California, much of it from the time before recordings existed, when nearly all music was performed live. One section features a type of music not often heard these days, songs composed exclusively for California politics. James Keller is the exhibit's curator.
Anybody who ran for office in the old days had a campaign song, and often they had more than one campaign song. One of them is this fascinating song, "Be Good to California, Mr. Wilson, California Was Good to You." Now, there's a mouthful of a title.
Keller is standing over an old record player known at the time as a talking machine. Many of these campaign songs were written for rallies and only exist today on sheet music. So hearing a period recording is a rare event.
We crank up the talking machine. That should be enough. And then we take off the brake, and it's rotating.
The Mr. Wilson in question here is President Woodrow Wilson. The song was written in 1916, 4 years before women could vote nationally. But women in California got the vote starting in 1912.
And they voted for Woodrow Wilson. And so what they're doing in this song is they're berating him a little bit on the fact that in the 4 years that have gone by in his first term, he still has not gotten national suffrage for women. And they're reminding him that he owes them. And a few years later, in fact, Woodrow Wilson did see it through, and we got the amendment that gave universal suffrage to women.
Well, now, where would this be played or sung?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Obviously, it was a popular song. It was put out by a major New York publisher, and it had rather famous authors, and so it was going to get some mileage.
The radio hadn't come along yet.
No, we're in the pre-radio era here. Now, obviously, it got some play on records. I know of one place where I'm almost certain that it was performed, because I ran across a newspaper clipping that detailed the suffragettes who were going literally to the doors of the White House.
That newspaper clipping, Keller says, reports that those female demonstrators spent part of their time singing songs about their cause.
And when I read this, I thought, well, I know one of the songs that they surely sang is "Be Good to California, Mr. Wilson," because I'll bet the California contingent of suffragettes were very active singing that song.
Well, this is a whole lot more creative than saying, what do we want? Votes. When do we want them? Now, which is about all you get from demonstrations today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And they actually articulated very specific things in some of these campaign songs. I mean, they really put forward planks through many verses. They'll sing about the things that they want.
Keller has selected a couple of other policy-oriented songs for the exhibit. No recordings exist, just the written music.
One is from Upton Sinclair, who you know, the famous author, but he ran for governor of California at one point on the EPIC program. EPIC was his slogan, E-P-I-C, End Poverty in California, which is always a good idea, but it was especially resonant in the Depression when he was running for governor unsuccessfully. But he made a good run at it.
This is a song that could be picked up by a candidate today. The lyrics, sung to a lively march tempo, include:
End poverty in California and bring happiness to forgotten men. End poverty in California and prosperity will come again. It's the battle cry of the real democracy, and it means the end of all hypocrisy. End poverty in California and Upton Sinclair will show the way.
And then we have a campaign song also from the Prohibition Party, which rarely won very many seats, but this was a campaign song of theirs called We'll Keep California Dry, which, again, they did not manage to do, but was sung a great deal because the song comes up a fair amount. I've run across many copies of it.
We are in this conflict for our children, our homes, friends, and state so dear. With our vision cleared, we behold the day that is dawning ever far and near.
And one of the interesting things about that song is that they kept a page blank in it so that all the different Prohibition Party candidates could fill that page by printing something about themselves or run their own portrait or whatever points they wanted to make in their campaigns.
The days of going down to the old sheet music store to find a campaign song are long gone. Now supporters of a candidate or cause can listen while others sing to them. Or they can watch while singing along on YouTube and simultaneously sharing their views with other interested voters.
Thank you for blessing me and the rest of the city with me.
We are the 99. Oh, we are the 99. You may be the other 1%, but we are the 99.
Whether it's a song endorsing San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee or an Occupy chant for the 99%, one aspect of campaign songs remains unchanged. They still have to deliver the message. In San Francisco, I'm Stephen Short for Crosscurrents.
Singing the Golden Gate, an exhibit of sheet music dating from the Gold Rush to the 1930s, is on display at the Society of California Pioneers in San Francisco through December 7th. You've been listening to Crosscurrents from KALW News. The team includes Zoe Bresny, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, RTM's Konahoffs, Holly J. McDeed, Erica Mu, Nina Nicole Morente, Mary Reese, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Isaac Silk. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. The lusty sounds you're hearing now are by the Barbary Ghosts. They're one of the scores of musicians and instructors taking part in this weekend's free folk festival at Presidio Middle School in San Francisco. The festival starts at noon and goes until 10 p.m. on both days, Saturday and Sunday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.